talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and good day to you all. Coming up now, Sir Charles Schulz III. He worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapons systems and computer-based automated test equipment. He wrote, get this, the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing II missile system, worked on the Patriot, the Copperhead tank killer, and advanced attack helicopter systems. Charles has performed research under Grant on nuclear fusion. He was knighted and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence. He has written many technical publications and magazine articles on space, astronomy, the atmosphere, and space resource development. In addition, Charles has also appeared on several TV and radio programs, and his big consuming interest right now is Mars. He is a remarkable man, and of course we're going to talk about Mars, but there are many other questions that I have, as I did last time for Sir Charles. He's just a remarkable interview, and if you'll just stay right there, it's coming right up. Sir Charles Schulz III, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here, and I hope I can live up to your build-up.
You will. Believe me, you will. And before we launch into Mars, I read a lot of, you know, like military action novels, fiction, but based on current military technological capabilities, the Dale Browns and, on and on and on. I just love that kind of stuff. I eat it up. And in most of these newer novels that claim to be based on currently understood technology or technology that's just around the corner, it really seems like we're headed toward robot wars. We're headed toward a time when things that fly through the air and bomb or do whatever they're going to do or just spy, it's all going to be robotic. The human being is going to be eliminated from aerial warfare, if I'm reading these right. Is that where we're headed?
Well, it certainly seems that way, because consider that a robotically piloted aircraft, for instance, can undergo maneuvers that a human being couldn't even survive.
Right.
So that, in one respect right there, explains a lot of the developments and the direction they're going and why.
Well, there's that, but there's also AI, and that's something I know you've worked heavily, artificial intelligence. You've worked heavily in that, and that figures into
correct.
It, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, because many times you have to make systems that, if something goes wrong, they have to be just sharp enough to be able to handle it on their own.
Right.
Because in most of these circumstances, things are happening far faster than the human mind could even begin to digest the information. And a perfect example is many of the planes today are fly-by-wire. The surfaces of the planes are being adjusted dynamically thousands of times per second, because the plane normally would be so unstable under manual flight that it'd be impossible to fly. But the payoff is, adjusting the plane this way allows you to make maneuvers that are otherwise impossible with a very stable airplane.
Yes. And G-forces that a human being couldn't survive. And then I even read that there will be people operating these planes, perhaps, from, I don't know, a mountain maybe under some, mountain in Colorado, where they'll be virtually on a joystick flying this plane on the other side of the world and killing people. I mean, armies of robots the whole thing is incredible to consider a war perhaps against who knows what nation, where they've got people and guns and we've got robots.
Yes, and it's not inconceivable in the least. I mean, think about how children are being raised on video games these days, and how the reflexes that they develop under those circumstances are just phenomenal sometimes. And it makes a very natural coupling between man and machine when you can put an interface in that's as simple as point and click, or like a video game.
Yes. How far from that?
I would imagine we're probably already testing some of the flight hardware now, and I would see possibly deployment, and this is just my opinion, but I would say within about 5 years.
There are people, Sir Charles, who would complain about the morality of that, that our nation would have machines not be risking flesh and the other nation having to risk flesh. It's not moral.
Well, you know, a lot of people argue that warfare itself is not moral, and
that's right.
They would say we're doing something to help protect the lives of our people, and so from that standpoint, all is fair in love and war, and it can be argued anyway, I suppose. It really depends on what your ultimate goal is. Do you want to protect your family and your country, or do you feel that you need to send people out to do hand-to-hand combat?
Well, it's sure going to be interesting to see where it's headed, and I suppose if you were to look very carefully into what happened in Iraq, it was probably a little bit of both, or a lot of both, perhaps, were used.
Absolutely, yes. It was a mixture of both man and machine in that instance.
I've heard we have done some incredible... I mean, for example, it really is possible to disable a city with some kind of generated electromagnetic pulse, right? I mean, virtually bring a city to its knees.
Well, it is, but understand that the cities that are most vulnerable are first world cities that have a lot of technology and electronics in the first place.
Like us.
Like us, exactly. One of the things that people didn't realize is, and this became a very effective weapon accidentally, we release chaff sometimes from aircraft as a shield for attack.
Right.
For instance, a missile may be homing in on a plane or a radar tracking it.
Sure.
And recently the chaff has been made as fibers of carbon, for instance, or strings of metal tinsel. The carbon filaments that they have tried have turned out to have a secondary effect that became very useful, and that is that they will short out power wires and bring generators down.
Oh, that's right, and we did some of that in Iraq 1, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
And then in Iraq 2, I believe, we decided that we wanted their infrastructure to remain as much intact as possible, and so we didn't, if I recall.
Right. We didn't want to bring the infrastructure down. And, you know, the whole theory behind it was we wanted to do it as cleanly and fast as possible, in theory.
Well, it must have been wild to work in the fields that you did. And having done so, I'm sure you can project where they would be by now and sort of have knowledge of where they would be by now. And you're saying we're pretty close. We could fight a war like that, say, in another...
Yes. I would say, based on what I saw back then and the things that I'm doing and other people in the field are doing, I would say we're very close to it, yes.
And
now, of course, we also have to consider some of the no-goes, like the DARPA vehicle challenge, and that's going to have another run next year. But we will see where that goes. That was a very ambitious project, and I think a lot of the people who got into that really discovered how hard it is to make your wonderful idea fly in the real world.
Why do you think DARPA... funded that? I mean, do you really think they were looking for, you know, just fielding for new ideas? Because they ought to be far ahead of anything that was launched into that field.
Oh, sure. If you think about it, what did it cost them? They didn't have to pay
much.
Off.
Well, no.
They published some documents. They wrote some reports up. They issued a challenge. Many other people spent their money developing this.
I wonder how far along DARPA, in fact, knows we are.
Well, I think it's interesting overall because the things that you try as solutions to your small technical problems sometimes turn out to have unexpected or radically different applications. And the space program is a perfect example of many, many spinoffs we generated, not even thinking about those things to start with.
Does that justify the space program, in your opinion?
That alone justifies the space program. I've seen estimates that say every dollar we put into space technology brings in from $10 to $15 in gross national product. And I don't know just how accurate that figure is, but it sounds very encouraging to me, and I know that we have many industries today that we would not happen to have if we didn't have space technology.
Well, but even if that figure is close, then the think tanks would be telling the government elected people to go for it. And why aren't they?
Well, of course, we have a couple of brick walls in our way, and one of those things is, to go much further, we really need outside mineral resources and energy resources. And so if we really wanted to see development, we'd have to get out into space with industry, you know, heavy industry and development, and go from that angle, because that will be a self-funding effort once it gets underway.
Is there, well, I'm trying to think, is there anything valuable enough on the moon or on Mars or on any other planet we could conceivably get to make it worth our while?
Well, yes, there is, but it's in an indirect manner at first, and that is, we certainly wouldn't mine mineral resources and send them back to Earth. We wouldn't manufacture stuff and ship it to Earth. That would be prohibitive and ridiculous. But what we would do is we would use those resources to build systems that we need in space, and one example of that would be orbital power stations or manufacturing stations. And I can think of a very simple application we could use right away. One of the problems we have today is shielding satellites and spacecraft, for instance, humans in orbit. Most of our space stations that we put up, in fact, all of them, have been in very low orbit because that close to the Earth, they gain a great deal of shielding from the Earth's magnetic field, so that the radiation hazards are greatly reduced.
Right.
If we were to make, let's say, lunar sandbags and ship them back to low Earth orbit, we could shield stations there, and people could stay in them for extended periods of time, regardless of radiation hazards.
Uh-huh.
We could even move them to higher orbits and do research from much higher vantage points.
So it would be relatively very inexpensive to pick up virtual sandbags on the moon bring them back to even low, well, not low Earth orbit, perhaps.
Or moderate height, medium Earth orbit.
It would be so much cheaper doing it from the moon and back, not having to, you know, escape Earth's gravity. That would make it financially feasible.
That alone would do it. And I'll tell you why. Right now we're spending in the thousands of dollars per pound for everything we put into space.
Sure, I know.
And by manufacturing it off the planet, we don't have that expenditure. We send up a starter factory that does the job, that's powered on sunlight, digs lunar materials, produces the goods, and ships them back to us. And now the cost becomes very reasonable. And it means that you can ship hardware into orbit, and you don't have to include a huge load of shielding. Now your payloads get lighter.
Well,
you shield them once you're up there.
Okay. All right, then. I was, of course, alive and aware as we touched down, put foot on the moon, and then as we, I don't know, stopped it all, except for low Earth orbit. We have just sworn the rest of it off. No moon. We haven't gone back. No Mars. We haven't really gone there. We don't have any concrete plans to go there. They've talked about it. Do you have any theory on why all of that happened? It's so illogical to go to the moon and then stop.
It certainly does seem that way. And, you know, I was one of the strongest proponents. I wanted to see us go on. Build lunar colonies, build hotels in orbit, and just keep going from there. And I think that the biggest thing was, and I know there are a lot of people who dislike this thought, but the race to the moon was really a Cold War challenge. We wanted to get there first and to show that we were the better man, and it was a race. And it didn't have a practical payoff, and it is only because we had some people who were able to influence decisions to get some science done and to get some real research done on the way, that we were able to actually pull something useful and beneficial out of it. So even though we went in peace for all mankind, it was really a Cold War challenge.
Boy,
so once the money dried up and the challenge was met, that seemed to be the end of it.
So that's the only reason we went to the moon, because we had someone to race with. That was it.
At the time, that seems to be the largest reason behind the drive for the space program. Because
really
it was argued
something.
That we who control space, if you control the high ground, you control the world.
Well, the moon is sure the high ground.
That's pretty high, that's right.
Wouldn't there be strategic military reasons to be on the moon in force?
Yes, there would be some. Understand that you would have unlimited mineral resources and energy resources to deal with. So once established, you could build like mad and nobody could touch you. But if you really want a quick response for a military reason, your biggest bet would be to put those defense stations in lower medium height orbit, because you can respond in minutes or hours, whereas something from the moon is going to take, if it's on a ballistic trajectory, 3 days to get here.
Well, Sir Charles, maybe we just need competition now. Chinese look like they're coming right along. So if those of you who hope for space travel, maybe when we get competition, we'll get back in the space business.
And, of course, there are some other things that we can look at as well, and that's the new technologies that make it cheaper. And I'm going to touch on some of that tonight as well.
That's the whole thing. That's the big argument, of course, against it, is that it's just too expensive, and we have a lot of urgent things to do here on Earth, like spend hundreds of billions of dollars on Iraq.
Exactly. And we need to build a highway, basically. Imagine how difficult it would be to go across this country if we didn't have the interstate highway system.
How about an elevator? Have you heard
elevators? There are space elevators on the drawing board, and they've been around for ages. And they are a viable concept, and we are now developing materials that would make them a viable method to literally hoist something off the planet with a cable. And there are numerous designs that can do this. And I don't know if any of the listeners are familiar with such things as rotavators or skyhooks, but there are probably a half dozen really good designs that could be carried out given slight advances in our material technologies.
Well, I've had a couple of guys discussing nanotechnology who said that there is some technology in the nano world now that would apply to perhaps building a real space elevator.
Right, that's probably fullerene whiskers, which have a higher tensile strength than diamond. And if we could learn to bulk manufacture that and build cables out of it, a length of cable made out of fullerene whisker, which is a carbon product, would be able to support a 3,400 kilometer long length of itself before breaking.
Wow.
And that's the sort of stuff we need.
And that could add up to an elevator to space. Such an incredible thought. And so then the price per pound to get stuff to space, once you've got that kind of technology, goes about where?
It could drop down to a few tens of dollars per pound at that rate.
Boy, would we be in business.
Absolutely. It'd be like buying an airline ticket.
Well, is there any chance, do you think, that our government will embrace such an idea? We talked a few moments ago about a power station in space, collect solar energy, send it by microwave back to Earth.
You know, that's the thing right there. Whenever anybody says, well, why don't they do this or why don't they do that, the answer is almost always economics. Who's going to put the money into it and how is it going to pay off? And so what we've got to do is establish a real good reason for being there. And I think we're right on the verge of a real good reason right now, and that comes down to energy. We need power, and we need power fast, and we're going to need a lot of it.
We sure do.
And if anybody who's bought gas within the last month knows exactly.
Sir Charles, can you give me any technical details regarding how you would accomplish that? The collection aspect, certainly I understand. Wow, you can get giant collection of energy in space. There, you can send it by microwave, I believe, and that's where I start to want some technical details about how you get giant amounts of power down through the atmosphere to a receiving station.
Well, that actually is not as difficult as many have led us to believe, and over the last couple of years, in fact, investigations have led to the conclusion that it may be more feasible technically right now to use infrared laser light rather than microwave transmission. Now, either one could be used, and microwave is a wonderful venue because it's low-tech and it's easy to do, but we may end up using infrared lasers instead.
Huh.
And as long as our collectors are aligned in such a way that it cannot lase until it's aimed at the collector, then you've got an absolutely safe system. And the moving of the focus of your beam does not become an issue at that point. So if you make it so that your receiver on the ground is one half of the circuit, then you can't just aim the other half somewhere because it won't work. Half the hardware is gone.
Right.
And that's the ultimate safety measure right there.
I wonder, any idea how much energy could be sent down on a laser?
Oh, absolutely. It just depends on the size and density of your beam. If we use a solar power station, and this is a typical figure the size of Manhattan Island, that's about 24 square miles, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
The sunlight falling on something of that size is equivalent to something like 85 billion watts, or 85 gigawatts.
Gigawatts.
And if we were to convert that from sunlight into electricity, and we got, let's say, 70% of that as useful electrical power, now we're talking at almost 60 gigawatts of power, and that could be beamed down in the form of laser light and collected at the ground. And if ultimately at the end we only got 80% of that recovered, and that's a high figure, it may be considerably less, we'd be talking about 47 gigawatts.
All right. Now, hold it right there, and we're going to come right back to this. This is so fascinating. As he points out, if you've been to the gas station lately, well, you know the importance of what we're discussing right now. Why not collect it in space and send it back to Earth? From the high desert in the middle of the night, I'm Art Bell.
Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
And Sir Charles Schulz III, and we're discussing right now the concept of collecting energy in space and then beaming it back to Earth as a viable, profitable, even important thing to do in this current day and age. And when you think about it, a lot of times it seems like the government wants to keep the realm of space all to itself, doesn't it? Let's think about it for a second. Why are we in Iraq? Well, yeah, all right. Weapons of mass destruction, but oil, right? It's oil in your a lot of your hearts. You know it's oil. I know it's oil. We all know it's oil. Been to the gas station lately? Right. It's oil. We fight wars. We send out our young people to die in wars because of oil. Well, we don't talk about it as the reason, but we all know it's the reason. I mean, it's like the biggest thing the world is facing right now is the energy problem. And so, Sir Charles, if it would be a profitable venture and it would be so friendly to the Earth and it's something we actually have the technological capability to do right now, and I'm talking about the power plants in space, then why the heck aren't we doing it?
Well, it's because of cost, mostly. And in a 1997 statement by John C. Mankins, who was the director of the Advanced Concepts Study Office of Spaceflight, and that's with NASA,
right,
what he basically boiled it down to was people would be willing to do it if it was under $1 billion to get it started and operating. And that's what we really come to, the cost. I feel that we'd probably be a lot closer to the $3 billion line right now today with the economics the way they are. And if it really became a priority for our nation for power,
yes,
we could find the money for it, and we'd find it fast. I mean, if you look at the defense budget in 93, it was estimated at $281 billion, and for 2005, the defense budget was estimated at about $347 billion. Some people put it much higher. But if you just took $5 billion of that, that's only 1.4%.
But I just heard the other day that we've already spent $200 billion in Iraq, something like that, $200 billion. I mean, that's real money.
Right. It is real money. It adds up fast when you get into the billions. And it would take such a small portion of that sort of an expenditure for us to start an energy venture in space. And I think that what it really takes is to get people interested enough that they're going to make their government hear that this is what they want. It's friendly to the planet. It's cheap enough to get started with when you really come right down to how much we spend on other ventures. And it would pay off in the long run like you wouldn't believe. Yeah. Once the starter hardware is in place, it can be used continually to build more systems. And we can sell that power to other nations just as well.
Well, yes to all of the above. And so I can't imagine why we're not doing it, unless you want to imagine, as many people do, that, you know, they want to pump the last little bit of oil supporting the current infrastructure for its, you know, refinement and distribution, and do profitably do it and not do this space thing or whatever other energy might come along until they've squeezed the last drop of profit out of oil.
Well, a wise leadership would see to it that it dovetailed with the development of another resource, such as solar in orbit. And you have to consider, the concept is, really, it's not a new concept. I mean, it was invented back in 1968 by a Dr. Peter Glaser. And since then, it's been touted as a solution to our problems many times, including by Gerard K. O'Neill from Princeton University, who developed the mass driver, which is an electromagnetic catapult of sorts that launches things into space without the use of rockets. Now, it only works on places like the moon without an atmosphere. But they would allow you to launch payloads without the use of rocket engines and to get things into space very cheaply and powered strictly by electricity. And this is an integral part of manufacturing orbital solar power stations.
All right, what's the real downside to orbital power?
You know, I've thought about this, and I cannot see a downside. I have tried to imagine what could possibly be wrong with it, and for the life of me, I can't see a downside.
You can't shoot any holes at all into it?
Well, imagine if you're collectors, and we're not talking about using solar cells as collectors, which are fragile and have a limited lifespan and efficiency.
Oh, what are you talking about?
In other words, we would replace it with mirrors, collectors which are made of very thin plastic with an aluminum coating on it, such as Mylar.
Right.
And we would use those mirrors to focus the collected sunlight on a heat exchanger. So let's say a closed-cycle steam turbine, a water boiler. That's a known rock-solid technology. It's dirt simple. The electronics are dirt simple. And it would take sunlight directly from a big collecting mirror and focus it on it. And if you shot holes in it, oh, well, you got a couple of small holes in something the size of Manhattan.
Right. And you would literally boil water?
That's right. In fact, all of our electric technology of any magnitude uses boiling water. Even nuclear plants, they boil water.
Okay, you've got to get... Water is heavy, right?
Yes, water does weigh quite a bit. And so our reaction fluid, our water, would be one of our points that we'd have to address. It is possible that there may be, and this is just an outside shot, there may be natural gas deposits on the moon. And if so, we could manufacture our water from them directly because they contain hydrogen. There also are deposits of polar lunar ice, which we could use as a starter. But realize, once we got this thing started, there's no reason why we couldn't use this same orbital power technology to provide power to lift payloads off the Earth, such as water as a working fluid, or to launch missions to recover water ice from other places in our solar system to fuel them.
There certainly wouldn't be a great deal of danger in launching the needed parts and pieces for this. None of it would be toxic, would it?
None of it would be toxic, that's correct. And the most interesting thing about that is they have a new chemical rocket, which is based on paraffin wax, the same thing candles are made of. And a paraffin wax rocket is a solid fuel rocket, but it has the advantage of being able to be throttled and turned off and restarted again. It uses liquid oxygen, and it uses paraffin wax. And the results of the combustion are water vapor and carbon dioxide, completely harmless materials from the standpoint of your bystanders. If the rocket falls out of the sky, you have a lump of wax on the ground or in the ocean. Nothing explodes, nothing burns up. Your liquid oxygen will go, but your paraffin wax basically is inert. You can give it to your kids. Everybody has candles.
Is there any danger. I've talked to a number of scientists, and I've had people call and say, you know, every time we launch, for example, the shuttle, we do some sort of damage in the upper atmosphere. And I always said, oh, pooey, it couldn't be enough damage to really be meaningful. We're just blasting through. Is that myth or fact?
Well, there's still a lot of debate about that, but understand that the engines, like the solid rocket boosters on the shuttle, have aluminum and a rubber-based sort of material that, and perchlorate, and the aluminum and the chlorine in it is what people are concerned about.
Should they be?
Well, they should be. If we made a lot of launches, obviously there would be a detrimental effect. We don't make very many launches, so overall I think the effect is probably very negligible at this point. But if we get to the point where we're launching 5, 6, 10 missions a year, 20 missions a year, 50 missions, I would be very concerned about it.
Really?
Now, we are at the point where they're going to retire the shuttle, and they're much better systems. And if we were to go to, for instance, paraffin solid boosters, they have almost the same yield as the solid rocket boosters on the shuttle. They'd have to be a little bit larger to make up for the difference in energy.
Well, maybe I'm missing something here, Sir Charles, but the shuttle about to retire, you said, I don't see its replacement.
And that's one of the major stumbling blocks at this point. There have been many things suggested, but nobody has yet said, this is what we're going to do. There have been projects, for instance, the Shuttle C was proposed long ago, and it was never carried out. And that was basically a carrier. It was a heavy cargo carrier that would launch with no people on board, but just take heavy loads into orbit and leave them there. Realize every time we launch a shuttle, we're bringing back a huge piece of hardware. And if we were smart about it, we'd be leaving a huge piece of hardware in orbit for the cost of the launch and bringing back just the people and experiments.
Yeah. I did a program with a man who thought that the external tanks, at a relatively small cost in additional fuel, could be, instead of dumped into the ocean or whatever, go ahead and take them up into space, and there are endless uses. In fact, you could build a space station out of the damn things if you wanted to. Yes, you can. You agree with that?
There are a couple of problems. I do agree with that, except for a couple of caveats. First of all, understand that when they separate the external tank, the pipes that run the lines, you know, the lines that run the fuel and oxidizer are about 17 inches in diameter, and they have something like 5,400 pounds of hydrogen and oxygen in them when they ditch it. I mean, that's a lot of fuel and oxygen.
Right.
There is often also quite a bit of hydrogen and oxygen still in the tank itself. If they were instead to build that, they could loft it into a higher orbit and stabilize it. And so that really isn't a big issue. It can be done. But then the next thing is, different launches don't necessarily have orbits that coincide, and so you'd have to corral these things somehow and bring them together. So that's your first big obstacle, getting them all in the same orbit, or in two or three well-defined orbits and getting them to meet up. The second big obstacle is, the foam on the outside of the tank decays badly in solar ultraviolet, so you end up with a lot of trash in orbit, outgassing little particles of stuff. And they're all very hazardous if they strike another spacecraft at high velocity.
Right.
And so you'd need something, a coating or something that would keep that from happening. And then the next objection is, well, once it's there, you don't just rip out the bulkhead and throw bunk beds in it. You know, there's a lot of work that's necessary to convert it into a useful station.
But again,
now, we did that, and it can be done. We did that with Skylab.
Yes.
It was basically a converted fuel tank.
Well, again, the argument is you're launching so much weight and bulk so high that it's wasteful to drop it back. Now,
I agree with that. Yes,
you do basically agree with the premise.
Absolutely with the premise. And it would take a little bit of work to get it, I think, to a workable state, and it could be done. But if we face the fact that we may not have the shuttle fleet for much longer, it becomes a moot point anyway.
Well, this really then is my next question, going back to what I originally asked. You said we're about to retire the shuttle fleet. And I said, well, I don't see what's going to replace it. How can we retire the shuttle when we don't have any other ways to get into space right now? I mean, how can we even consider doing that since we have no other way right now? Or do you know more than you're saying?
Well, there's a little more to it. They are designing presently capsules, just like the old-time space capsules, that can carry 4, 5, 7 people and some cargo. And this sort of capsule could be launched on a standard Atlas IV or whatever's available and taken into orbit, just like the old spacecraft were done. And you would send up on a different launch vehicle, a space lab module or something to the space station, and this capsule would rendezvous with the station and then come back down pretty much as other capsules have done in the past. There are also designs that include gliders that can come back in that are much smaller than the shuttle that carry basically just passengers and some small amount of supplies.
Well, am I missing
none
something?
Of it's been built.
There we are. Nothing has been built. Doesn't that worry you? I mean, the timetable seems all wrong. You've got to be designing long before you retire.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that concerns me is I haven't seen any real proposals put forward at this point. Now, of course, we've got our commission report, the Aldrich Commission report, which happens on June 10th at 11 a.m., and that should outline and address a lot of these issues. It should. We will see where it goes from there. We have to wait until Thursday to find out what they have to say.
Uh-huh. Well, all right, then let me leap ahead and ask you something way out on the edge, and
okay.
I know it's going to be interesting to ask, and it is the following. Having just reviewed the fact that we haven't gone back after the moon for whatever reason, that we're not even building anything to replace the shuttle, and that all of this is mostly in government, not private hands, at least at the moment, the ability to go to space, I mean, there are a number of people out there who believe that there are artifacts possibly on the moon and artifacts on certainly Mars that would tell the world's public a story that a government doesn't want told, that there are secrets being held, that there is or was life on Mars, intelligent large life, or something else. I'm not really sure how I'm trying to put this to you, but there are secrets out there that they don't want the world to know about yet. A lot of people believe this. And with all the research you've done on Mars, do you wonder?
I certainly have questions. It's not out of the question that some other race might have visited our solar system in the past, but it would speak volumes if they had, because it would mean that they had technologies beyond what we have, far beyond perhaps, in order to go from star to star, or it would mean they were very, very patient in order to take the long journey at light speed or slower, or it would mean that they were probably machines and it didn't matter how long it took. There are a lot of ways you can interpret it. I won't even put my foot into the arena about whether or not there are artifacts made by other intelligences on other bodies in our solar system. I know that the issue has been talked about extensively, and one of the earliest people to really address it seriously was Enrico Fermi, who basically did very, very early nuclear research and got us going on the right path back at the beginning of the atomic age, and it's called the Fermi paradox. You know, if a civilization were to build spacecraft and send them from system to system and begin spreading out, even if they only got there at one-tenth of the speed of light over the course of history, in just a million years or so, they would have covered the entire galaxy. And where are they? Mm. And we don't see any such artifacts, or at least we're not aware of them. Maybe they are there, maybe they aren't. I don't know. I think we would have to do a lot more looking, serious research and studying, before we'd be able to say for certain.
Mm-hmm.
If they are there, it'd be a wonderful find. It would tell us a lot. And we would expect that such an artifact would probably be very, very old. On the other hand, like I said, I haven't seen any evidence of anything of the sort. I just know that theoretically it's possible.
Would you agree that NASA is suspiciously slow to acknowledge what appear to be finds on Mars that are extremely suggestive of lots of things that most people don't believe to be true right now?
Well, they are slow to make an acknowledgement in some cases, but, you know, they have themselves in a precarious sort of situation. If they were to declare that a thing were so and then found out later that it was not, they'd lose face and they'd lose funding. And if they were to declare that a thing were not so and later it was found out not to be what they said, once again, they're going to lose face and funding. They find themselves really between a rock and a hard place in a lot of ways. On the other hand, a lot of the things that we have found lately, in particular the research I've been doing, it indicates clearly that the conditions on Mars, for instance, are very different from what we've been told all along. And And I expected before now to have heard some sort of positive response. And the only response I've gotten basically has been from people who are not connected with NASA. And they have given me verifications right and left.
Yeah, well, that's why I asked you the whole question.
Right.
Because I figured by now you were running up against the Mars stone wall and perhaps beginning to get a little frustrated. And I can see it starting to happen.
Yes, but, you know, I have to say one thing. As I said before, the facts are here, and it will come out in the end. And some reckoning of it has to be made. And I don't know if that's going to be happening on the 10th with the Aldridge Report or not. I don't know if that's going to be happening later or at all. It seems that the best way to deal with an issue that's controversial these days is to ignore it to death. And I know that this is something that really shakes up a lot of people's fundamental beliefs about Mars, for instance, the findings of liquid water, you know. But it really isn't that controversial when you come right down to it, because Gil Levin, who did work on the labeled release experiment on Viking and was sure that he had found signs of microbial activity on Mars back in 1975 or 76, was doing some work on spacesuits in a vacuum chamber under Mars-like conditions, and he and his son were working on a project, and they discovered that liquid water could indeed exist in that vacuum chamber under Mars-type conditions. And what's interesting here is no amount of theory, no matter how wonderful it is, can stand up to a single empirical observation. They could see water in the chamber at the pressures and temperatures that exist on the surface of Mars. And now, with these pictures of the geysers and other things that I've got on my webpage...
How long a duration experiment was that?
I'm not really familiar with too many of the details of it, except that they tested suits under various conditions for proposed Mars missions in the future.
Oh, remarkable.
It is.
All right. We're coming to the top of the hour, so we're going to pause here. But you do have a lot of specific information for us tonight on Mars, even since the last program, right?
Absolutely.
Hold it right there. I'm Art Bell.
I've been drifting on the sea of heartbreak, trying to get myself ashore for so long, for so long. Listening to the strangest stories, wondering where it all went wrong for so long.
This is Coast.